Sometimes the future isn't just written. Sometimes it's rewritten. And sometimes it fights back. You're listening to the Curvature Chronicles. You're listening to the Curvature Chronicles, the Curvature Key. In the last episode, Castor and Sarah got close. Will they get closer? Or will the Kryn finally enforce his will? We continue to learn about the artifact, and it continues to learn too. Here we go with episode 6.
The campus library was nearly empty when Castor arrived. Unless exam time was looming, it usually was. The towering shelves threw long shadows in the amber lighting. A storm rumbled outside. The stained glass windows softly rippled with distorted patterns. He didn't know exactly what he was looking for, some long-buried detail from his anthropology studies. It was clawing its way to the surface of his memory. He moved into the history section. Castor made his way to the stacks of cultural anthropology and comparative mythology. His fingers trailed across the worn spines until they halted on a dusty volume. Portals of the Ancients, a comprehensive study of threshold lore. Castor pulled it from its place. It felt familiar. He flipped it open and began to scan. A chill crept through him as he read about Norse Bifrost, that legendary bridge that connected Asgard to Earth. It was said to shimmer with light and color, allowing gods and the rare mortal to traverse dimensions. In certain variations of it, the bridge was said to respond only to beings of aligned frequency. The next page brought Castor to Yggdrasil, the World Tree. According to Norse belief, it threaded through 9 realms. Scholars argued that the branches could represent overlapping dimensions or alternate temporal realities. The next eye-opener was the Egyptian Duat. The underworld wasn't a place of death, but of transformation. It had 12 gates, each one protected by a guardian. Ancient priests claimed that properly spoken words and offerings could alter the passage through time. Castor stared at the illustration of a solar bark sailing beneath the stars, steered by Ra. One glyph on the boat looked strangely similar to the spiral pattern on the back inside cover of the book. His breath caught in his throat. He remembered a section and hastily flipped to it. There he was face to face with a chapter on the Mayan and Aztecs. A map of cenotes in the Yucatan Peninsula described them not merely as water sources. It described gateways to the underworld, Xibalba. Sacrificial objects and carved stones recovered from the depths of those waters. They were usually aligned with planetary movement. In the Popol Vuh, the Hero twins had descended into the underworld. They navigated its traps and returned. One stone carving shows a being emerging from a swirling portal, his arms outstretched to the stars. The caption underneath read, "Marked by the gods, they pass unharmed through time's veil." Castor leaned back in his chair. These weren't isolated myths. His heart was racing. These were echoes, different names for the same type of thing. 3 cultures, separated by continents and hundreds of years apart, all describing a realm beyond this one, a pathway only a chosen few could have access to, the potential to cross into or reshape time. His phone buzzed. A text from Sarah.
"Checking in. Be careful. Don't trust the quiet."
He looked up. A man in a gray coat stood near the window outside the library. The Kryn, Castor felt a wave of energy come from his backpack, from the book, as if it knew. He tucked the volume he was reading under his arm and headed to the back exit. He vanished into the shadows of the museum wing. Castor had more questions than ever, but maybe, just maybe, he finally had a trail to follow. Something was connecting for him in all of this. He was beginning to believe that he hadn't been just a guy in that antique store. The book had selected the store, not to get away from the Kren, but to get to Castor. Now he just had to figure out the reason.
Castor locked the door behind himself the moment he got to his dorm. The lights flickered slightly as the storm gained some momentum. He dropped his backpack, tossed his jacket on the floor, and fell onto the bed without even changing. The weight of everything, the book, the alien Kren, the alien Sarah for that matter, what he'd found at the library. His mind and body had been pressed too hard, and they gave out. Sleep was almost instant. But no dreams this time. A soft blue glow pulsed inside his backpack. The glow of the book seeped through the fabric, washing the entire room in eerie light. Slowly, by itself, the bag unzipped. The book floated upward, almost seeming to tremble. It landed on the pillow next to Castor. Then, a burst of blue energy poured into Castor's forehead. He jolted. He was standing in the snow-dusted hills of what looked like Scandinavia. Fire crackled through a longhouse in the distance. A woman in furs stepped from the shadows, her pale silver eyes appraising Castor. She put her hand on his arm. His arm felt a warmth spread through his body.
"Friendy,"
she said as she patted his arm.
"You're not supposed to be here. Ah, but it's too late now."
Before he could respond, he was falling. The world ripped away. Then he was standing in the shadow of a pyramid, sand whipped against his face and around him in spirals. A robed man with a painted face raised a golden ankh toward him.
"The gates are open. The judgment has passed. Do what the portal tells you."
Again, falling. Into heat and humidity, deep within a cenote, lit by bioluminescent moss. Statues of feathered serpents lined the walls. From the shadows, what Castor was sure must be a Mayan priest emerged. His eyes looked far more ancient than the rest of him.
"You do not guide the portal. The portal guides you. It always has."
Castor Ames opened his mouth to speak, but could not. The air was too heavy. It had grown too thick. The pressure unbearable. He awoke with a gasp. The dorm was silent, except for what he realized was his own rapid breathing. The book sat innocently on his desk, closed and not glowing. But he couldn't shake the feeling that it was watching him. It hadn't just shown him the myths he'd read about. A chill ran down him. It had spoken to him through them. The message for him had come through loud and clear, too. "You're already too far into this. Stop resisting." But Castor Ames wasn't sure he trusted that voice. Even if the part of him that the book was syncing with really wanted to.
Sarah lightly stepped across the creaky attic floor of the Four Corners bar. With her left hand, she brushed the panel controls hidden within a dusty storage cabinet. The edges of the portal shimmered behind her, dormant for now, but humming with possibility. Her last communication with her handler had been brief,
a clipped affair, and had brought on more questions than it had answered. Zarathian protocol forbade directly interfering. The recent silence from the Kren, however, was unsettling.
Maybe he died from the cold,
Sarah thought aloud. But she didn't think so. She pulled out a small, crystalline receiver. It wasn't any receiver, though. It was embedded with her genetic marker. She tacked it twice. Blinking purple, it searched. Searched. Then it pulsed green. There. Not far from the university district, a faint, cold, but lingering residual trail. Unmistakably Kren. She narrowed her eyes. He was circling again. Sarah descended the attic stairs with quick precision. Grabbing her jacket, she was out from behind the bar in a moment. The staff on duty barely glanced up. She worked here, and her shifts were trademark quiet. But tonight she wouldn't be clocking in. She stepped into the night, hood tight, blending easily into the pedestrian flow. Her senses were wide open. The Kren left behind a strange, almost inverted heat signature. Not warmer where he'd been, like humans, but a slight chill to the air below the ambient temperatures. A product of his body trying to suck more heat out of the atmosphere than was there. Like walking into a pocket of deep space. A garbage can dented in from the side. A pigeon nearly frozen in place on a railing. Small signs, but telling. She was close. Observe. Always observe. Her lack of following that order is what got her here on Earth to begin with. Sarah clenched her jaw and pressed on. What if the Kren kills Castor? She thought bitterly. She moved silently through the alleys. Somewhere nearby, she knew that the Kren was out there, watching. She was ready to make sure he didn't get any closer to Castor Ames than he already had. Castor woke up with a jolt. His mouth dry, arms and legs felt like they weighed a ton, heavy with metaphysical exhaustion. The clock blinked 7:42 a.m. in angry red numbers. The book rested on the edge of his desk like a well-fed predator, still, silent, patient. He rose up from his bed slowly. Something inside him felt different, changed, not just because of the visions, but because they made too much sense. These weren't dreams or feverish hallucinations. They had purpose, rhythm. These had a direction. The book had chosen him. He knew that now, without any doubt. He showered quickly, pulled on a shirt, and headed back to the university library. He wanted to be there the moment it opened. The storm had passed, but the air still seemed to carry a charge, like the atmosphere remembered. Once inside, he passed by the anthropology section. Instead, he continued on to the restricted stacks of historical anomalies, all the reports, sightings, and rejected academic papers. Professors, he knew, tended to write these off as pseudoscience or crackpot theories. He wasn't most professors. A folder caught his eye. The Turin Jump, 1621. In northern Italy, an apprentice to a stonemason had vanished for 3 days. When he returned, he raved about tunnels of light, filled with impossible machines and a floating silver glyph. Before they put him to death for heresy, he claimed he'd seen the construction of a temple that didn't exist yet. A different folder yielded a handwritten entry. Yellowed with age, it chronicled a shepherd from Anatolia. In 840 BC, this shepherd predicted a devastating earthquake days before it happened. He said that he'd been struck by a book of fire that had fallen from the sky,
humming his name. The most recent account Castor found detailed an obscure World War II soldier. He'd claimed that a glowing object pulled him out of a foxhole seconds before a mortar round obliterated it. He had reappeared about 3 hours later at a field hospital without a scratch on him. No memory of how he got there, only a page from a journal in his pocket. No one knew what the page said because it was in a language no one could identify. Castor massaged his temples. It was happening again and again throughout history, across centuries, across cultures. If you took each thing individually, they all looked like isolated incidents. But if you looked at them all together, they weren't isolated. They were fingerprints. He was far from the first to go through this, but just maybe he'd be the first to understand why. The storm outside had thinned to mist by the time Castor and Sarah met at his apartment. Streetlights bled across the windowpane, gold halos trembling with every gust. The artifact sat on the table, faintly pulsing, neither fully awake nor asleep. Sarah stood by the door, hood down, hair damp from the rain.
You shouldn't have gone to the library alone.
I'm getting used to that advice no matter where I go.
Castor half smiled as Sarah moved closer, boots whispering on the floorboards.
You don't understand what it's doing to you, what it's doing to both of us.
The artifact?
She nodded. The pulse from the book deepened, slow and steady, like a heartbeat that belonged to neither of them. Castor took a breath.
Then tell me how to stop it.
Sarah's expression softened as she reached out and took his hand.
You can't stop resonance, Castor. You can only ride the current.
The air between them thickened. Her touch sent ripples through him. The hum grew louder. Dust rose from the shelves in weightless spirals. He pulled her close and kissed her. Her arm circled him as she kissed him back. He couldn't tell if his heart was going to beat out of his chest or just threaten to. Then she let go and pushed him away, leaving her hand on his chest.
Castor,
she whispered as she glanced at the artifact on the table.
The artifact is magnifying this so much. If we go on, you might regret it.
Sarah, look at me. He lifted her chin gently until her violet eyes met his.
My regrets, my entire life, have stemmed from the things I haven't done. The things I was too scared or too nervous to do.
Both his hands cupped her face now, cool against her warm skin.
Sarah Sudis, you will never be a regret.
For a heartbeat, neither of them moved. Then the hum from the book matched the rhythm of their breathing. Light crawled across the walls in thin electric veins as they leaned together. Their lips met, hesitant at first, then certain. The resonance flared, folding sound into silence. The world tilted. The temperature shifted. When they broke apart, light still clung to them, tracing the outline of their faces like molten glass. Sarah stepped back, trembling as the surrounding air flickered, a pulse of light that seemed to breathe with her heartbeat.
Castor, it's reacting to us.
Castor smiled, slow and deliberate, his eyes never leaving hers.
I don't care what it's doing.
He tugged the hoodie off over her head, the static from the fabric sparking faint violet in the dim light.
What was it you said to me in that geography lab basement? Oh yeah, I remember.
He drew her close until the hum of the artifact faded behind the sound of their breath. As he closed his arms around her, he said,
Sarah, hush.
The alley smelled of oil, rotting Chinese takeout, and lots of poor decisions. Neon lights flickered on overhead, painting the damp pavement with sickly shades of yellow and green. Byrne hated it,
Even though he and his mates were comfortable here, kings of the block, he really just wanted to get out and see what else the world had to offer. Somewhere further down the block, a pop synth bass line rattled against a window. The bass line was trying to get out too.
Hey, buddy, you lost.
Byrne turned to see who his friend, Schotz, was yelling at. It was a tall guy in a long coat, walking, in their alley, alone. Three shadows peeled off the wall near the dumpster simultaneously. Guy didn't walk like a local. Definitely wasn't, or he wouldn't have been where he was.
Yo, trench coat!
Byrne barked, stepping in front of the man. Byrne's jacket was patched with gang sigils and graffiti tags. He slipped a long knife out of his front pocket and snapped it open.
My man asked you a question.
The Kren stopped. The stranger stared at Byrne in a way the young thug couldn't quite place.
My man said, are you lost?
Slowly, the Kren turned toward each of the three young men. Lidless eyes regarded each, without fear, without real interest, just a faint kind of clinical curiosity. Now Byrne placed where he'd seen that look before, on the biology teacher's face before he'd made them dissect a frog. Schotz, never the patient one of the crew, and to Byrne's knowledge, hadn't made it far enough in high school to get to biology class, stepped forward.
Empty your pockets. We might show you the way out.
The guy said nothing. No shift in breath. No signs of tension. Just the soft wind blowing stink into Byrne's nostrils. Getting cooler all of a sudden also.
Look, man. If you don't, we'll cut your creepy gray ass open and sell your clothes.
The third thug in their group was more cautious. He had hesitated a couple of steps back. Now he spoke up.
Something wrong with this dude. Look at his skin.
Too late. The Kren moved. Not the way humans understood movement. It wasn't fast the way humans understood fast. It was so precise. Time seemed to bend for him, like it did for the Flash in those comics Byrne used to read when he was a kid. Everyone but the Flash rooted to the ground, and he ran circles around them. One moment, Bren stood there, blade drawn and ready to strike. The next, his arm twisted backward at an impossible arc, the sounds of breaking bones and cracking cartilage filling the air between beats of Bren's heart. It happened so fast that he saw the entire thing before the pain started. Once it caught up, though, he dropped to the pavement, screaming for his mother. Schotz tried to lunge at the man. The dude was so fast. From Byrne's point of view, from the ground, it looked like all the guy did was flick his wrist. Then, Schotz, flying backward into the alley wall. He couldn't be sure, but it sounded like Schotz's ribs broke from the impact. The third turned and ran. Smart, but not fast enough. He didn't see the Kren close the distance. He only felt the cold leaching into his bones through the layers of his clothes. He fell to his knees, convulsing, breath steaming in the suddenly cold air. The man walked back toward Byrne. He leaned over and whispered,
"Where I come from, air burns in reverse."
Byrne clutched his mangled arm and stared at the man, practically vanish into the mist, like a smudge of ink on a piece of parchment. His breath fogged in front of him slightly. Byrne wondered when he'd gotten so cold.
You've been listening to the Curvature Chronicles. In the pulse of the artifact, Castor and Sarah found something real. The passion feeds the storm, and the storm is far from over, because in the shadows of the city, the Kren hunts. And he's closer than they think. If you're enjoying the story, don't forget to follow the show on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, or wherever you listen. Until next time, keep your eyes on the curve, because every story bends reality.